ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
How did life begin? Research into our earliest beginnings, the origin of life, continues at an accelerating pace, with published papers and press releases popping up in our news feeds about this or that breakthrough in our understanding of abiogenesis, the idea that life could have come about through purely natural causes on the early Earth. In recent years, origin of life research has accelerated, at least in volume, though as we too often find out, not necessarily in meaningful results. Sometimes it's helpful to take a critical look at the evidence and the assumptions underlying the exciting claims that regularly pop up in our news feeds and scroll across our screens. Hello, I'm Eric Anderson, and today I'm joined again by Dr. Robert Stadler, co-author of The Stairway to Life, An Origin of Life Reality Check. Dr. Stadler received a BS in biomedical engineering from Case Western Reserve University, an MS in electrical engineering from MIT, and a PhD in medical engineering from the Harvard-MIT Division of Health Sciences and Technology. He has worked in the medical device industry for more than 20 years, has over 140 patents, and has contributed to medical devices that are helping to improve millions of lives around the world. Welcome, Rob.
Oh, hello, Eric. Thank you for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Sure. So just to set the stage, as you know, I've done some writing myself about the origin of life, so I follow the area pretty closely, and I see papers being published and stories in the news almost on a daily basis about this or that new research that supposedly helps us understand the origin of life. A few days ago, a new article came out that said, new research by the University of Oslo provides evidence that the protocells that formed around 3.8 billion years ago before bacteria and single-celled organisms could have specialized bubble-like compartments that formed spontaneously, encapsulated small molecules, and formed daughter protocells. This statement was followed up with the news story in Inside Science that said, surface bubbles could have evolved into Earth's first cells. Artificial protocells suggest the complex biochemical mechanisms used by living cells could have originated in simple bubbles. This paper and news story are hardly unique in the kinds of claims they're making, of course, but I thought this would give us a good opportunity to help our listeners understand a little more about the idea of a protocell, what it does, this idea, or doesn't show us about the origin of life. So first, Rob, just describe for us, what is this concept of a protocell, and why is it something that researchers are interested in?
Yeah, well, I think you would get everyone to agree that existing life that we know on the planet today, even and especially the most simple forms of single-celled organisms that we're familiar with, are far too complex to have formed spontaneously in their current state from individual molecules. You know, for example, the simplest of genomes of organisms that can live on their own, for the most part, are about 500,000 base pairs of DNA, and that's about as much information as you'd get in a paperback book. So surely that didn't just come together as the first embodiment of life, formed by molecules that are just aggregating. So everyone seems to acknowledge that there must be some earlier form of life that was vastly simplified and then replaced somehow by what we can find today.
Yeah.
And it's those earlier forms of life that tend to get the label of protocells. And it's kind of like a stopgap that's essential to support this theory of abiogenesis. And I need to kind of separate the term protocells that I'm describing from what you often find in the literature. You'll find dozens of papers using the term protocells. And like the one you just mentioned, when you actually read the paper, you find that what's in their bubble, basically it's a glorified bubble, has really nothing to do with life. And it's not something that could possibly progress toward life.
Right.
But they're using that term protocells very loosely. And what we're talking about today is something that actually would have the capability to progress toward life as we know it today. And that kind of a protocell is entirely imaginary. It's an imaginary entity that's, like I said, it's a stopgap. It's envisioned because some people have a strict adherence to what I've called the materialism of the gaps. In other words, you know, there's this big gap they have to fill, and they don't know how to fill the gap, but they so strongly believe that natural causes did it. They just say, well, it must have happened by natural causes.
Mm-hmm.
So the concept of abiogenesis is completely dependent upon protocells. And yet there's an inconvenient truth that there's really no evidence whatsoever that protocells ever existed. And as we'll see in the point of this podcast is that there's actually plenty of evidence that the concept of protocells doesn't even make sense.
Yeah. So if, you know, you talked about materialism of the gaps, if I am convinced as a matter of principle that there must be a purely unguided natural explanation for life, then obviously there had to be something previous, right? There had to be some quote unquote proto entity that evolved into what we see today. And so that's really where it's based. And it's interesting to see that even in some of these papers and news articles, they put protocell in quotes. That might give us a hint that something a little fishy is going on. So
it's nice that they at least include the quotes to give you
exactly. So if we look at the real world though, Rob, what evidence for protocells do we actually see?
Yeah. So historically there is, you know, there's no fossil record. There's no evidence whatsoever. So the evidence that people attempt to provide comes from, you know, modern laboratory work, like the paper you started with of these bubbles. And so, you know, we have this big gap between simple molecules or chemistry and then living organisms or biology. There's this huge gap between them. And so there are people trying to bridge that gap from both ends.
How do you mean both ends?
So there are people working from the very simple molecules trying to build up toward life. And then there's people on the upper end taking life we have today and trying to go backward and simplify existing life downward.
Okay, let's start with the first one, going from simple molecules up to life.
Yeah, so the paper you mentioned is an example of that. And these almost always have a focus on the membrane, or what they would call a proto-membrane. Everything can be proto when it's imaginary. But the membrane is so important because it defines the boundaries of the cell. And, you know, we know very clearly that one of the major components of modern cell membranes is phospholipids. And under just the right conditions, you can take phospholipids and put them in water, and they will self-assemble into a spherical bilayer, a phospholipid bilayer. And so if you squint one eye or you look at it kind of out of focus through your microscope, you might actually think that you're seeing a cell there because they have that kind of size and they have a distinguished boundary to them. And this you see so often in videos and in papers, and this simple concept of phospholipids forming a bilayer has provided the origin of life researchers an inordinate amount of misplaced encouragement. They get quite excited about this and always put it in front of your face.
Yeah, so it doesn't really have anything to do with the cell, as I think you'll probably go on to share with us, but it kind of looks like it's, you know, a little round object. So maybe it's a membrane that could have been the cell, right?
Yeah, and that's where the analogy ends.
Yeah.
what they won't tell you is that this kind of very simple membrane, it really can only serve as a tomb for the decaying of the components inside. I mean, an analogy here you can think of is take yourself a nice black plastic garbage bag and hide inside of it and close it up really tightly.
Yeah, don't try this at home, kids.
I mean, it succeeds in separating you from the environment.
Sure.
But you can't get any nutrients inside and you can't get your waste out. Mm. And so it just produces death and decay. Mm. Another analogy is, you know, I live in Minnesota and we've survived cold winters here. And the house that you live in is a nice membrane. And it has the ability to maintain homeostasis, to maintain an environment inside that is stable and distinct from the environment outside. But the house, even though it's a membrane, it has doors and it has windows that can be opened selectively only when you need it to get nutrients in and to get waste out.
Right.
That's more like what you want in a cell. You don't want a garbage bag.
Yeah, I like that analogy. Yeah, you've got doors and windows, you've got pipes, you've got electrical components, you've got ways to get all of the things that you need in and out, unlike just a sealed membrane or a sealed compartment, like you say. You know, I get the sense that a lot of origin of life researchers have little appreciation for the actual requirements for a cell membrane. The membrane has to be tight enough to maintain a proton gradient, has to be sufficiently permeable to allow large molecules like amino acids and nucleobases and fatty acids in and let waste out. So the membrane has to meet kind of a conflicting set of requirements, and a simple phospholipid bilayer seems like it can't do that.
Yeah, in order to meet those conflicting requirements, the cells have to have active and very specific transporters, or like doors, that are embedded into the membrane. And when I talk about active, you know, go back to the house analogy. If water is rising outside of your house, there's a flood, and the water by diffusion alone is going to find a way into your house. And so what you have to do is get a pump, you know, and plug in the pump, provide some energy to that pump to get the water out of your house against the natural diffusion gradient.
Oh yeah, that's good. I've got a pump in my crawl space under my house as we speak.
And that's exactly what the cell membrane has, a lot of literal pumps that are literally consuming energy to very specifically push something in or out against a natural concentration gradient.
Right, right.
So a simple cell like Mycoplasma genitalium, it has more than 140 different proteins that are all built to work inside the cell membrane and serve as these doors, active doors. Some, they're not all active, but a lot of them are. And about half of the weight of the cell membrane is actually proteins and not just phospholipids. So why do we think that simple forms of life, even the most simple forms, have to have such complex membranes? And it's because these proteins, serve as very specific doors, opening exactly when needed, transporting goods in and out, and maintaining homeostasis. And so the bottom-up approach, trying to build from simple chemistry up to living things, has been unsuccessful because it's just oversimplified. You know, bubbles alone can't do this. They're not going to meet the requirements to maintain life.
Right. Yeah. And just to clarify, Rob, when you say that there's more than 140 different proteins operating within the cell membrane, you don't mean they're inside the membrane, inside the bubble. You mean they're actually embedded in the membrane and are actually part of the membrane itself, if you will.
Yeah, very good.
Allowing things in and out, right?
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. They're like part of the membrane, yes.
Yeah, and that's very different from these quote-unquote bubbles and protocells and phospholipid bilayers that we see in the papers all the time that are just, you know, they're hoping that I've got this simple shell and there's going to be interesting stuff going on inside of it, but there's no way to get things in and out like you've talked about. Good.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing to think how sophisticated even a membrane is, because that's one of the things, a lot of the lay people, we tend not to give much emphasis to that, right? There's all this interesting stuff going on inside with DNA and RNA and molecular machines, but boy, the membrane's pretty complex as well. So in addition to the paper I mentioned at the beginning, we often hear about other research with simple lipid bubbles that makes it sound like researchers have created a simple membrane just because it happens to be in this shape. Like you say, you kind of look through the microscope and gee, it kind of looks like a cell, but it sounds like we're pretty far from that. So researchers haven't had much luck starting from the bottom up in moving from simple molecules toward life. And this reminds me, actually, Jim Tour is doing a YouTube series on Origin of Life, and he talked about a recent survey where the public, many members of the public, thought that Origin of Life researchers had created a simple organism like a bacterium in the lab, and it's just not even close to being accurate.
Yeah, I was quite surprised by those survey results. It was like 70% of the population believed that already.
Right, yeah, over 70%. It was crazy. So it's you know, disappointing how much misinformation is out there, and that's why these kinds of discussions are so important.
Does new evidence of cosmic design fascinate you? If so, check out the new book from philosopher of science and best-selling author Stephen Meyer, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. The science is airtight, and at the same time, it's written so that non-scientists can follow the argument and see the many amazing ways modern physics and cosmology point to a grand designer of life and the universe. Check out the glowing endorsements from Nobel laureate Brian Josephson and others at returnofthegodhypothesis.com. That's returnofthegodhypothesis.com. That site also gives you links to Amazon and other booksellers that are selling the book. Pick up your copy today at returnofthegodhypothesis.com.
All right, so we've talked about bottom-up. What's the other approach, I guess, top-down?
Yeah, the top-down approach, so building from current life and kind of building it backwards, but engineering it or reverse engineering it to go backward. You could you could call it kind of dumbing down existing life. And there's a lot of people that have tried to simplify existing life, starting with very simple single-celled life already and knocking out genes to see if they can still survive. And so you can start with organisms that have about 500 genes, and summarizing all of that work in a very brief statement, very little progress has been made. You know, Craig Venter is very well known in this field.
Sure.
And he published a paper in 2016 in Science, and it was called Design and Synthesis of a Minimal Bacterial Genome. And they've worked very hard to try to simplify a genome. And their simplified organism had 473 genes, so there's little progress there. And the first sentence of their conclusion is, the minimal cell concept appears simple at first glance, but becomes more complex upon close inspection. And this is because, you know, if you simplify the genome of a living organism, what you're doing is adding additional requirements for the cell's environment. You're just sort of pushing the complexity out to the environment instead of inside the cell.
What do you mean by that? That's an interesting concept.
Yeah, so if you consider like a human and how a human can survive, can you take the legs off of a human and they can survive? Well, sure, but you're going to have more requirements placed on your environment. Like you need a wheelchair, you need ramps to go up and down steps, you need a nice flat surface to roll your wheelchair around. Can a human live without teeth? Well, sure, but your requirements on your food have to increase. You know, it has to be well blended. Mm-hmm. Can you live without kidneys? You know, we know you can live without kidneys, but you need a very sophisticated dialysis machine. So the more you try to simplify life, the more requirements you place on the environment around you in order to help keep you alive. And the same thing happens with a single-celled organism. You basically are putting the requirements on the environment. The environment has to provide the homeostasis, you know, where everything is handed to you on a silver platter just at the right time, just at the right concentration, the right temperature, the right pH, all of that.
Hmm. So let me pause you here for a minute, because this is a really critical point and something that I've also been trying to emphasize to people. So I would say there's an incredibly naive idea in origin of life research, and particularly in the evolutionary framework of thinking about life, that it would have been easier for life to arise on the early Earth without other biological molecules around. And you know, we could spend a whole episode talking about this very interesting history, but just in brief, you know, if you go back to Darwin's Warm Little Pond back in his 1872 letter to Joseph Hooker, where he talks about perhaps life arising in this warm little pond, and then you fast forward 100 years to somebody like Richard Dawkins in The Selfish Gene, who talks about the early Earth being a kinder, gentler place. That's my word, not his, but that's his description. You know, the early Earth is a kinder, gentler place for life to arise. What's now becoming clear is that this is just utterly wrong. And it's not just a case of, gee, you know, Darwin or Dawkins or some of the origin of life researchers have a good idea, but we still need to see how it pans out in practice. No, this is completely backwards. It couldn't be more wrong. As you simplify the organism, you have to have a more helpful, more benign environment in order for it to survive. So what are we seeing today in terms of actual research in this, what's needed for a simple organism?
Yeah, it's not just even a benign environment, but one that is just pristinely almost designed, you would say, in order to be
helpful, set up to.
it's like a life support system, you know.
There you go.
A neonate in an incubator, the little incubator that has just the right temperature, just the right everything. That's what the environment would have to be.
I like it.
So another example of this, there were three papers published together in the journal Science in 2009, and they all studied Mycoplasma pneumoniae, which is responsible for walking pneumonia, as it's called. And it's one of the simplest known life forms that can reproduce autonomously. And it has a genome of 689 protein encoding genes. And it's interesting to note that back in 2009, anyway, 231 out of the 689 genes had functions that we didn't understand yet. So there's still a lot we have to learn about even the simplest of life. But in one of the papers by Yuce et al., they found that in order to keep this organism alive in a culture, they had to provide 19 specific ingredients, including water, and basically have this perfect nurturing bath for the organism to stay alive. And, you know, some of the ingredients are very familiar, like glucose. They also needed all the nucleobases like cysteine, guanine, adenine, some fatty acids like palmitic acid and oleic acid, some vitamins, nicotinic acid, and proteins, you know, peptides. So it's quite a specific environment that it needed in the minimal form in order to stay alive.
Yeah. And just to clarify again for our listeners, when you say there was a minimal genome of 689, that's after they had reduced it down, or is that before?
They didn't reduce it from there. This was the actual genome of the native organism.
You're just seeing what the minimal environment is and the minimal...
To keep a minimal organism alive, yes, you need these many nutrients.
Yeah, and a lot of those things that are on that list are components that would not have been available on the early Earth, right? Some of these are biological substances that would not be around on an early Earth, but are needed for this simple organism to survive.
Yeah, some of them are quite complex, you know, and certainly hard to imagine the early Earth providing them, especially all 19 in just the right concentrations in the very exact same location. Yeah, pretty difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. So this underscores the point we've just been making, that if several of these ingredients were not available on the early Earth, then even to survive, this simple organism would have had to find a way to construct these ingredients on its own, which requires more genes, more information, more molecular machines, more functions. So the problem of survival and the amount of coordinated functional complexity required gets worse when you go back in time and toward a more primitive environment, not better. So if there's any abiogenesis researchers that are tempted to imagine that the early Earth is a more friendly, more favorable environment in which life can arise, then just like Darwin and Dawkins, I would suggest they have it exactly backwards.
I would agree with that completely. And if you were to take this simple organism and begin to knock out more of its genes, you could only keep it alive if you had even more requirements placed on the environment. And at some point, you know, no environment will keep it alive, of course.
Yeah, yeah. So if protocells ever existed, why don't we see them today?
Yeah, so we have more experimental evidence to answer that question. You know, when you really look at the studies of experimental evolution, where they try evolution in a laboratory, you know, they all make it clear that existing life is actually constantly trying to simplify itself to the extent that it can and continue to survive. I'll cite one paper from Kuo and Ockman from the Genome Biology and Evolution Journal, 2009. They said that looking at simple single-celled organisms, they found that deletions of DNA outweighed insertions or additions of DNA by at least a factor of 10. In prokaryotes. In other words, by default, these organisms are trying to shed DNA that they can live without, if they can live without it. So if some of the DNA isn't needed for survival, they're going to delete it, you know, just like you delete spam email because you don't need it and it's extra baggage, it gets in the way. And I can also cite Richard Lenski's experiment, the famous E. coli experiment.
Sure.
Everybody, I think, pretty familiar with this, that it took only about 2,000 generations for his E. coli to completely jettison an entire operon, the ribose operon, which is a part of their DNA, they're part of their genome that allows them to eat ribose. And, in the environment they were in Lenski's experiment, there was no ribose. So they didn't need to process ribose. And so if they eject that entire operon and simplify their genome, they were actually able to reproduce 2% faster. So that's a significant advantage. But of course, it's gene loss. But it tells us the simple message here is that existing life, ever since there has been life for all of history, has been trying to simplify itself. And there are benefits to simplifying yourself, of course, if you can continue to survive. The point is that why bother in a laboratory to try to simplify life when you can just look at the life we have today and realize that it's been trying to simplify itself for as long as there has been life? So we can predict that laboratory efforts to simplify life will only be successful in that they end up providing a more coddled environment. You know, they have to provide more requirements on the environment if they're going to simplify the requirements on the cell. And I don't think you're going to see any progress of any significance being made trying to bridge this huge gap we've been talking about from a top-down kind of procedure. And we've seen that very clearly from the literature. It's very clear and evidence-based.
Yeah. Okay. So both the bottom-up approach and the top-down approach seem like they're running up against some pretty significant and probably insuperable challenges here. So the idea of a simple protocell, what's the takeaway, Rob?
Yeah, my favorite takeaway is from back to those three papers I mentioned in Science that were talking about the Mycoplasma pneumoniae. They concluded, even though this is a very simple single-celled organism, they concluded, quote, "The reduced genome of Mycoplasma pneumoniae belies an underlying eukaryote-like cellular organization, replete with intricate regulatory networks and innovative pathways, revealing that there is no such thing as a simple bacterium." That's what they found. So protocells exist only in the imagination, and all evidence is telling us that existing life is as simple as possible, and yet it's far too complex to have arrived through some kind of natural process. So the next time you hear someone say protocell or some paper or video says protocells, just think of that as imagination or fantasy. And science makes it clear that these protocells are an absurd idea.
Yeah. Well, this has been really helpful, Rob, in parsing through some of the claims that we so often hear about in abiogenesis research. I am really grateful for you being with us today to help shed some light on this important subject.
My pleasure. Thank you, Eric.
Please join us again for more episodes of ID the Future on your podcast app or at idthefuture.com. If you find discussions like these to be a valuable contribution to the public conversation about origins, please share a link to today's episode with someone in your life or consider helping us spread the word by giving the show a positive review on your podcast app of choice. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is Copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.